American history is full of the good, bad, and everything in between. But in the end, these are our stories. Today's episode, we'll cover the Matewan Massacre, the Baldwin Felts Agency, and the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum. So pull up a chair and join your host Jacob for episode 50 of The History Book. Hello everyone and welcome to a brand new episode of The History Book. As you may have heard, today is special episode 50th of The History Book, and today I am joined with Lloyd from here at the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum to talk about, well, the West Virginia Mine Wars and a little bit about what the museum does here as well. So I have a list of questions. We're just going to go through these, and you'll notice that just like every other episode, there'll be some breaks in between just to give us a chance to breathe and a chance for you guys to really hear what we're saying. So the first question is, why was West Virginia coal so sought after and really is still sought after?
Well, there's a couple of reasons why West Virginia coal was in high demand. First, having to be quantity, there was a whole lot of it. When the railroads were first starting to come in, one of the prospectors found a 13-foot tall seam of coal. And there had been some coal mining going on before the Civil War and before the railroads really started coming in. Mm-hmm. But you see a big seam of coal that thick, and if you're a railroad prospector or like if you're a coal operator, you start seeing dollar signs.
Yeah.
Another reason that particularly Southern West Virginia coal was sought after was the volatility content. It was what you might call low volatile coal. Mm-hmm. Which means all of the, like, really sort of flammable stuff, there's not a whole lot of that in there. It'll still burn for, like, heating coal and stuff like that, but a lot of the coal that was coming out of southern West Virginia was being used to make this stuff called coke.
Yeah.
Just to get a little bit into that process, you would take the coal and it would bake at a really high temperature in these, what were called beehive ovens, because, well, they looked like a beehive. Mm-hmm. And it would burn all of that volatile material out, and you'd be left with pure carbon. And that burns longer and at a higher temperature, and you could use that to power blast furnaces to make steel.
Yeah.
So it made really good metallurgical coal.
Okay. Well, clearly West Virginia coal is very important to the story that we're talking about today, which is the Mine Wars, of course.
Yeah.
And that kind of brings me to sort of talk about some of those main actors in the Mine Wars. You know, the UMW is formed early on. Mother Jones is an important character in this area, as well as the Baldwin Felts.
Yeah.
So could you tell us a little bit about those main actors?
Sure. So the UMWA was formed in January of 1890 in Columbus, Ohio. It was the coming together of a few different already established coal mining unions, and it will be the main union that tries to get a foothold in West Virginia. And it had some pretty solid success early on organizing coal fields in the Midwest and in Pennsylvania and even in northern West Virginia to an extent. Mm-hmm. But in southern West Virginia, operators really fought tooth and nail to keep the union out of their operations. Mm-hmm. And the reason they did that is they saw a lot of the, like, what they would have to pay for miners as cutting into profits. It was the single biggest business expense of being a coal operator, wages.
Yeah.
And they figured if they had to pay a union rate of, I forget the number itself, but
it means they're not making as much profit.
They're not making as much profit, and they're not going to be able to compete as well with the mines up north and in the Midwest. They see not being unionized as a competitive advantage.
Yeah.
So that's why they hire mine guards, and that's why when the union starts pushing harder and harder, they contract with the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency. Baldwin Felts has its roots in these sort of railroad detectives, people like guarding train cars and stuff like that. William Baldwin had been an agent for the Norfolk and Western Railway, which mm-hmm. is the main rail line that ran through southern West Virginia at the time. And he partnered up with Tom Felts, and they set up this detective agency in Bluefield, West Virginia. And I have to say, detective is doing a whole lot of heavy lifting in that description.
Yeah.
The miners preferred to call them gun thugs. And these were basically armed enforcers that would... you'd bring in, if you were a coal operator, to intimidate the miners out of unionizing. They would do stuff like carry out evictions. They would threaten miners. They would beat miners. And in some cases, miners would turn up dead if they were caught talking to the union.
Because if I'm not mistaken, they operate out in Colorado, out in the West for a while.
They were basically the foot soldiers of the Colorado Fuel and Iron Company mm-hmm. during the Colorado strike in 1913 and 1914.
Yeah.
But they're headquartered in Bluefield. Their headquarters are local to southern West Virginia. So they've already sort of established themselves by the time the Colorado Mine War happens.
Yeah.
They were involved in the Paint Creek and Cabin Creek strike mm-hmm. in 1912 and 1913.
Right down by the turnpike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they actually chartered the Bull Moose Special, the armored train car, or the armored train that would patrol the rail lines and do stuff like fire blindly into tent colonies with the machine guns.
Yeah.
So Baldwin Felts really becomes a player pretty early on, definitely by the 1900s. And they're already... they're a household name in the worst way possible in southern West Virginia by the time those big strikes first start to happen.
Yeah.
Now, Mother Jones is also, like, kind of a folk hero in all of this. Mm-hmm. You could argue that her role in this is largely symbolic, though she is an effective organizer for the United Mine Workers. Mm-hmm. So much so that she was actually employed by the UMWA as kind of like this roving organizer. She would go around to places where miners were being oppressed or trying to organize a union, and she would really sort of almost whip them into a frenzy. Mm-hmm. And her basic rhetorical style as she was trying to get miners to join the union was essentially to insult their manhood.
It works.
Yeah, she'd basically come in and say what kind of man would allow this kind of stuff to happen to them.
Yeah.
Basically saying, you all need to stand up and fight for your rights.
Yeah.
And it was effective, and she referred to the miners in southern West Virginia as her boys. Mm-hmm. And she was a pretty constant presence in the strikes in the early part of the 20th century, around 1902, when that strike didn't really go well because of just how beaten down the West Virginia miners were.
Mm-hmm.
It was really hard to organize them because they had been so immiserated. And they saw more risk in going with the union than they did with keeping their nose down and working.
Yeah.
And she actually got arrested during the Paint Creek and Cabin Creek strike, and she was put on trial by a military tribunal and sentenced to a prison sentence in Moundsville.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not a place you want to be.
Not at all. Her sentence ended up getting commuted in part because of her age. She was already in her 70s by the time all of this is happening.
A military tribunal sentenced a 70-year-old woman to Moundsville.
Yeah.
Of all places.
Yeah, and you could argue that it was out of her reputation. There were coal operators who called her the most dangerous woman in America.
Mm.
And, like, it's just this literal little old Irish immigrant who is just an absolute spitfire of a woman. So she did do a lot of the groundwork of getting miners into the union, and I think I would argue that without her, the unionization drive in West Virginia wouldn't have taken off as quickly as it did.
Yeah. Well, right now we're going to take a brief social media break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Battle of Matewan and Sid Hatfield. Hello everyone, this is the host and producer of The History Book, Jacob, here to remind you that you can stay in touch with me and The History Book on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, as well as on our website, www.thehistorybook20.wixsite.com. As always, feel free to say hi, or even leave a review of your favorite episode on Apple Podcast as well. Thanks, now let's get back to the episode. Thanks for staying tuned through that brief social media break. Right now, we're going to start talking about the events leading up to the Battle of Matewan. If you want to kind of describe what's leading into what happens here.
Sure. So, after World War I, a lot of the controls that the government had put in place on the coal industry to make sure that a strike didn't happen in the middle of trying to fuel this massive war effort, those started to go away. And a lot of miners ended up losing the protections that they had gotten and a lot of the guarantees that they had gotten for better working conditions during the war. Mm-hmm. Around that same time, you have a new president of the UMWA. His name is John L. Lewis. Mm-hmm. And he would go on to be the president of the UMWA until the 1960s. So he had a very long tenure, and when he assumed office, one of his main goals was to protect the gains that the miners already had, and to unionize Southern West Virginia. And he and district officers from UMWA District 17, a guy named Fred Mooney, they held a massive rally in Bluefield, West Virginia, like just down the street from the Baldwin-Felts headquarters. Talking about how they would not stop until all of Southern West Virginia was Union territory.
Yeah.
So Baldwin Felts kind of used this as like a declaration of war.
It sort of is.
Yeah. And the next step after that for the Union is to go in and start trying to organize Mingo County, West Virginia. And by the springtime, you have a strike conditions breaking out. In February, I think it's February 26th or 27th, you have a mass meeting in Williamson, and you have somewhere around 5,000 miners joining the union. They signed their union cards in and there. The issue was there had been Baldwin Felt spies among the miners. So they took down the names of the people who signed the union card, and the very next day, everybody who had joined the union was immediately fired. And around the same time, a lot of the coal companies had started using what's called a yellow dog contract. They're called that because, according to a miner, you'd have to be a yellow dog to even sign one. And those contracts are basically a promise from the miner saying that they will not join a union, be it the UMWA or the Industrial Workers of the World, which were still a pretty big and radical presence at that time. So if you sign that contract and then join a union, they have cause for firing you. And of course, if you were fired, you were evicted from your house because you lived in a company house. So as these strikes start building up and workers get fired and have these tent colonies popping up, in Mingo County, the tent colony was along Lake Creek, and it was a pretty big, colony. Like, it was one of those, it was rough living. The UMWA did as much as they could to support the miners. They provided strike relief. They provided tents. But the longer those strikes go on, the more...
You're living in a tent.
Yeah, and the more strain it puts on the national or international organization, too.
Yeah.
Like, these strikes, you're kind of working against the clock. And to sort of tie it to some current events, it's basically the strategy that the motion picture studios have admitted that they're trying to use in the writer's strike.
Yeah.
Basically saying, once the writers start not being able to pay a mortgage or rent and start going hungry, they'll be able to dictate the terms of a new contract.
Yeah.
So the strike continues on in the spring of 1920. Mm. And all the while, violence is starting to ramp up. There's shootouts. And as these evictions are carrying on, the town government in Matewan, which was not a company-owned town, is really sympathetic to the miners. Like, Matewan kind of becomes a little bit of a refuge for the striking miners.
Yeah.
The mayor, Cabell Testerman, he is definitely pro-miner, and he appointed a pro-miner chief of police named Sid Hatfield.
Mm-hmm.
Sid had been a miner himself. He becomes pretty well known as, like, a friend to the coal miner. And the town government does pretty much everything they can to support the strike as well. The union headquarters ends up in a building just down the street from where we are now that's currently under renovation.
Mm-hmm.
And the miners, like, the first Matewan locals headquarters are in Matewan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in that building. So we get to May 19th of 1920, and a trainload of Baldwin Felt's agents comes into town. And there's about 9 or 10 of them, and included in those 9 or 10 are Albert and Lee Felt's. These are the brothers of Thomas Felt's, who runs the company.
Mm.
And they show up and mate one to carry out evictions that were ordered by the coal companies. Sid and Mayor Testerman are waiting for them at the train platform, and they immediately ask him what their business is in town, and they produce warrants for the evictions and a warrant for Sid's arrest. And they take one look at those warrants, Sid and the mayor do, and the mayor says, these warrants are no good. You're going to have to get a judge in Charleston to sign off on these. And some heated words are exchanged, and Baldwin Felt's men go about their business, carry out their evictions, and they're trying to get back in time to catch the train out of Matewan that evening.
Mm. Well, I think this probably brings us right up to that next question. And as I've written it down, this is probably the question of the episode here. Who shoots first?
We still don't know. The answer to that kind of does depend on whose side you're on.
Yeah.
So
I think I heard one side this morning when I stopped at the Matewan Public Library to drop something off, and I heard a Baldwin Felt side.
I've
studied this a little bit myself to know that there are so many accounts of how this went down.
So the generally accepted account, about 4 o'clock that afternoon, there's a little bit of a light rain, and Sid and Mayor Testerman come back to meet the Felt's brothers and their posse.
Mm-hmm.
They're on the platform. The Baldwin Felt's agents have their guns stowed, and the same argument really starts to break out. A bunch of heated words are exchanged, and eventually, like after a couple of minutes of this, a shot rings out. Sid pulls his guns and starts firing, and the battle only lasts a few minutes. It turns out that there had been miners up in some of the top rooms of some of the buildings out by the railroad tracks, and it kind of looks like the entire thing was set up
as an ambush.
Which, by that point, the miners had been subjected to, years of abuse, and they decided they were going to take matters into their own hands. When the dust cleared, 7 Baldwin Feltz agents, including both of the Feltz brothers who were there, were dead. A couple more were wounded. A miner had been shot as well. And Mayor Testerman is lying down on the ground. He had been shot in the stomach and he was bleeding out.
Mm-hmm. He'll eventually
die. He eventually succumbed to his wounds.
Yeah. The battle goes down. Mm-hmm. Shortly after the battle, it's not much long after, Sid Hatfield marries Mary Testerman's widow, Jesse. I've heard a little bit of there might have been a little conspiracy theory there. But
yeah, there's...
Do we know anything as far as why that happens?
Sid's account was Testerman's dying request. He wanted to make sure that Jesse was taken care of as he knew he was dying.
Fair enough.
And it does look really bad.
Yeah.
It is a few... Like you said... just really shortly after the massacre.
It's days.
And they're in Huntington. They're actually arrested for gross indecency in a hotel room. But they're in Huntington to get married.
Yeah.
And this already... this fuels the sort of Baldwin Feltz propaganda machine. Of course, Thomas Feltz... two of his brothers had just gotten killed by Sid Hatfield and his allies.
Yeah.
And he essentially swears out revenge against Sid specifically. And once this incident happens, once Jesse and Sid do get married, Feltz starts circulating this rumor that Sid had killed Testerman himself to get to Jesse. There's not really a whole lot of basis to that besides the rumors that are circulating.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the court testimony from C.E. Lively. He was a restaurateur. He had worked as a union organizer. He was also a Baldwin Feltz spy.
Uh-huh.
And he claimed that Sid had come into the restaurant bragging about how he had shot Testerman himself.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah, and... you can see how Lively would have a vested interest in that story.
Yeah.
So it doesn't look good, but at the same time, it's still one of those points of contention that we're probably never really gonna know what happened.
Yeah. Well, this does bring us to the next question of, what are some of those consequences of the Battle of Matewan?
Sure.
I know one of them. One huge consequence that I'm really looking at is what happens to Sid.
With the Battle of Matewan, Sid kind of unwittingly signed his own death warrant. It takes a little while to get there, but in the meantime, on June 1st, the District 17 president, Frank Keeney, he called for a general strike in Mingo. Sid becomes kind of a folk hero, and the victory, if you can call it that, of the Battle of Matewan leads more miners to join the Union, which leads to more mine guards and more shootouts. And that summer, the governor of West Virginia declares martial law, and that brings federal troops in to keep the peace. And they put in place all of these policies no more than 3 people can be gathered out on the street at any given point in time.
Yeah.
And
stuff directly to put an end to what's happening.
Right. And in the weeks after the battle itself, Sid and some of his deputies, somewhere around 20 people ended up being charged with murder for what happened. The trial doesn't actually start until January the 28th of 1921. And in the lead up to that, one of Sid's distant relations, a guy named Ance Hatfield, not that one.
Yeah.
he is going to testify against Sid.
Yeah.
He turns up murdered. And we still don't really know who did that either. But the trial happens over the course of about a month. And it's kind of a raucous affair. You have state police and federal troops basically guarding the courthouse in Williamson against this like surge of minors and supporters of Hatfield and the other defendants. And this is where C.E. Lively reveals himself to be a Baldwin-Felt spy.
Hmm.
The jury eventually turns in a verdict of not guilty. All members of the defending party, all those who were charged, were cleared.
Hmm.
So Feltz kind of realizes that he's not going to be able to get Hatfield in Mingo County, so he starts looking for other ways. And in July of 1921, Sid's summoned to McDowell County. He has to go to the courthouse in Welch to answer for some charges there that are only maybe tangentially related to the Battle of Matewan.
Yeah. It was something Cole something, they said he might have blown something up.
Yeah. Yeah, it was something along those lines.
Yeah.
It was pretty obvious that this was a trap.
Yeah.
Sid knew it himself, but him being a stand-up lawman knew that he had to go. He had to answer these charges. They were against him and his deputy Ed Chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And he managed to get a promise from the sheriff of McDowell County that they would have safe passage to and from Welch. Now, for some reason, the sheriff himself was out of the county at that point in time. Sid, Ed Chambers, and their wives, they arrived in Welch, and once they got checked into the hotel room, Sid and Ed left their guns in the room. They were told to come unarmed. They would have it. Deputy escorting them to the courthouse to make sure that nothing happened. So they get a little bit of breakfast, and C.E. Lively is in the restaurant.
Hmm.
They take note of each other, eat their breakfast, and after that they head up to the courthouse, and Lively follows them. And once they get up to the courthouse steps, the deputy steps aside. Lively draws a revolver, and several other Baldwin-Felt's agents show up, and they just start firing on Sid and Ed. Lively himself performed the coup de grace on Ed Chambers as he was laying there dying, walked up and just put a bullet in his head. An eyewitness who was pretty young at the time recalled later that they shot Sid and Ed down like dogs.
Yeah.
And this is really the straw that breaks the camel's back. By this point, you have martial law in Mingo County. A pretty substantial number of miners have been arrested by these, like, citizen peacekeeping organizations in Williamson. And they're being held in this, like, open-air internment camp without trial. And all of this is a powder keg, and Sid and Ed's assassination really sets it to blow.
Yeah.
You have a rally of 5,000 miners gather outside the West Virginia State Capitol, and district leadership, Frank Keeney and Fred Mooney, demand to see Governor Ephraim Morgan and get him to put a stop to all of this, essentially, like, get the coal operators to come to the table and agree to the union's demands for, like, a union contract and better working conditions in general. The governor refuses to even see them.
Yeah.
And Frank Keeney addresses the miners and tells them, the only way you're going to win your liberty is with a high-powered rifle. Tells them to go home and wait for marching orders.
I think that's going to bring us right to our next break here. So we're going to take a brief musical break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the Battle of Blair Mountain. Thanks for staying tuned through that brief musical break. Right now, we're back talking about the West Virginia Mine Wars Museum, and I think when we left off, we were right at the Battle of Blair Mountain just about to kick off. So if you want to tell us a little bit about what goes down there.
All right, so word starts to spread among the striking miners throughout August that they're going to march on Mingo County and liberate the miners who are being held in Williamson themselves. They figure that they're not going to get any help from the governor, and the state police, which is only a couple of years old at this point, is basically there to quell any sort of like labor unrest, so they're not getting any help there either. So they figure if like the state authorities are not going to do anything, it's time for them to pick up a rifle and do it themselves.
And this is how many years after World War One?
This is about 2 years.
Yeah, so they have those rifles.
Yeah, a lot of the miners had actually served in World War One.
Yeah.
And of course, the whole Wilsonian, like, high-minded, make the world safe for democracy rhetoric, when they get home, they see that they don't even enjoy that, or they know that they didn't even enjoy those same ideals in the company towns of southern West Virginia. And for perspective, we're talking about 8 out of every 10 miners lived in a company town. So you have all these servicemen coming home, and you have there were even a few of the marchers who wore their doughboy uniforms.
Yeah.
So they were perfectly outfitted for this march.
Yeah, so all these miners who are now very upset, have been turned away from the governor, are marching towards Mingo County with guns.
Yeah. And Mother Jones, of all people, sees this going very, very badly for the miners. And she probably had something there, but the way she chose to go about trying to convince the miners to turn back basically destroyed any trust that they had in her.
Yeah.
So she shows up where the miners are assembling in Marmet, and she is trying to convince them to go home, and she produces a piece of paper that she says is a telegraph from President Warren G. Harding himself. And it says that he will intervene on the side of the miners and help them get their demands if they all just go home. When Frank Keeney asks her to let him see the paper, she refuses. So he comes to the conclusion that this telegraph is a forgery.
Yeah.
And it essentially turns all of the miners against Mother Jones.
Which is really sad for everything she had done.
Yeah, and like, she really took this as a, like, a personal betrayal.
Yeah.
It was heartbreaking for her. She never stepped foot in West Virginia for the rest of her life, and she died about 1931.
Wow.
So the marchers continue on to Boone County, stop in Danville and Madison. There's a few stops and starts to this. At different points, the miners get word that they need to go back home and keep with the strike, or that things are going to improve. And essentially, the cog that really ends up getting jammed is Logan County Sheriff Don Chafin.
Mm-hmm.
He is very firmly in the pockets of the coal operators, and his deputies keep carrying on these abuses. And there was an ambush that they had laid for a party of coal miners that had gone sort of at the front of the pack, so to speak. And this really sort of re-energizes the miners to keep the march going. Now, Fred and Frank, they're going back and forth from where the miners are to District 17 headquarters in Charleston. And things have escalated to the point where Harding sends a general named Harry Bandholtz to keep a lookout on things on the ground. Like, Governor Morgan has been telegraphing almost nonstop, begging the federal government to do something to stop this before it becomes like a full-blown revolution in West Virginia.
Yeah.
And
to that point, Harding has every right to send federal troops.
Yeah.
He has to have a request from the state governor in order to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Because there's a similar situation that happens with, you know, North Carolina in 1898. The state governor never requests federal troops, so, you know, McKinley can't send them.
Yeah.
But still, it's the same
situation. Is that the Wilmington Massacre?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. So you have kind of the opposite situation here. The governor is requesting federal troops, and Harding is kind of slow to act there. Like, he doesn't think that things have gotten quite that bad yet. But
Harding's not known for being a good president.
No, he was basically nominated because he looked good and he was actually kind of charming.
Yeah.
But Bandholtz is on the ground in Charleston, and the commander of the U.S. Army Air Corps, Billy Mitchell, arrived as well with these big, like, World War I type bombers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's trying to make the argument that you can, like, this is a good test case to see how aircraft could be used to put down, like, a domestic insurrection. And it's kind of a chilling thing that he says as he's being interviewed. The direct quote is basically like, we're not going to bomb these people at first. We're going to drop gas on them and see if we can get them to disperse like that. And if they still don't go home, then we're going to start dropping the bombs on them.
Wow.
Which, the bombing campaign is definitely a fiasco when the battle actually does get underway. A couple of bombers just crash.
Well, that's what you get flying in West Virginia hills.
Yeah, definitely. We have a photo in the museum of a plane that actually ended up crashing onto a house.
Wow.
Going on leading up to the battle, the momentum's building and the miners are coming up with, like, at least some semblance of organization. They have a common purpose, but they start adopting, like, phrases to keep, like, secrecy and everything like that, make sure who to tell friend or foe. They start tying red bandanas around their neck because those are something that everybody has or could easily get.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the origins of the term redneck.
Yeah.
But they also adopt phrases like pickets. They post pickets and guards, and if someone comes up on a camp, they shout out, "How do you come?" And the response to not get shot is, "I come creeping."
Mm.
So you have these different sort of groups that are all converging through Logan County by this point. And Don Chafin has basically sworn that no Union man will get through Logan County. And he's already notorious for beating Union organizers within an inch of their life and then dropping them on the other side of the county line.
Hmm.
So he has about 3,000 men deputized. They call themselves the Logan Defenders. And that's the narrative that gets pushed in the aftermath. Like, these people were defending their homes against this mob that's descending on them. The West Virginia State Police also get involved, and at the end of August, going into September 1st, you have a few skirmishes between miners and these different groups. By September 1st, you have kind of a pitched battle at Crooked Creek Gap.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what really kicks off the battle. So the battle takes place over the next 3 days. The Logan defenders commandeered a plane and started trying to drop bombs on the miners' positions. There are bullets just whizzing around everywhere. And like they'd get embedded in trees and everything like that. It's kind of a miracle that there weren't more people killed.
Yeah.
I think the official death toll is somewhere around 100. But those numbers always kind of get...
Yeah.
Like, fog of war and everything.
Yeah.
And by September 3rd, Harding has finally decided he's going to send federal troops in. And 6,000 federal soldiers show up in Logan County to put an end to the fighting one way or the other. And this is what finally convinces the miners to put down their arms and go home. A few of them do surrender their arms directly to federal troops. Others hide them in empty stumps, bury them in the hillside, and think they're going to come back for them later. And a lot of them don't, and you can still, if you look in the right places on Blair Mountain, there have been a few archaeologists who have found firearms just buried up there.
Wow.
But the miners saw themselves as patriots. Keep in mind, too, that a lot of them had served in World War I. They weren't about to face off against the United States Army because they didn't see themselves in rebellion against the United States.
Yeah, it was against the state.
Yeah.
The cooperators.
Yeah, they were fighting for their civil rights.
Yeah.
They were fighting for not just the right to organize a union, but the right to be able to talk about organizing a union.
Mm-hmm.
They were fighting for freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of the press. A lot of the rights that we take for granted.
Yeah.
As the battle winds down and the miners go home, then the treason charges start coming out. Only a few miners were charged for treason, but somewhere around 500 miners who took part in the battle were charged with all sorts of crimes, like destruction of property, criminal trespassing. I think there were a few murder charges in there.
Mm-hmm.
And by that point, Frank Keeney and Fred Mooney, who were both charged with treason, they had actually gone to Ohio to sort of lay low for a while once they figured out that this had sort of
gone horribly.
Yeah, spun out of control.
Yeah.
Once they come back into West Virginia, they're apprehended, and all the miners are taken to Jefferson County, West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
The treason trials take place in Charlestown. I don't remember if it was the same building, per se, but
it's the same town as John Brown.
Yeah, the same town that John Brown was tried for treason in after the raid on Harper's Ferry.
Yep.
And we actually have one of the jail cells that the miners were held in.
Yeah, yeah. I was talking to Mackenzie about that. I've actually been here before.
Yeah, yeah.
And toured it around, and that was the one thing that I remember was the jail cell from the Jefferson County prison.
Yeah, we have one little bit of it. We've got the entire cell, too.
Yeah.
I wish we had space to set it up, but...
Yeah,
that's one of the more powerful images, I think, that the museum has.
Yeah.
It's between that and the check tags that represent the people who died in the Monongah disaster.
Yeah.
Not to get too off topic, but that, like, I make a point to look at that every day when I come to work here, and that reminds me why I do what I do.
Yeah. Well, I think that will, that brings us to the conclusion of the Battle of Blair Mountain, the treason trial.
Yeah, which... There were very few convictions Keeney and Mooney ended up being acquitted of treason. The longest that anyone stayed in prison was about 4 years. The last person who was being held on those charges and convicted was paroled in 1925. In the short term, it was a disaster for the union movement in West Virginia and the UMWA as well.
Yeah.
The UMWA spent lots of resources trying to defend the miners, paying for legal services and everything. At one point, there were just about 1,000 union miners from West Virginia. And that's down from even just 10,000 alone who marched on Mingo and fought at the Battle of Blair Mountain.
Yeah.
Had it not been for the New Deal in 1933, the UMWA probably would have collapsed, and John L. Lewis would have a very, very different image in history.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to my next question, and I think this is a really important question to ask, and that's, how did women play a role?
Yeah, women were not just passive observers. And the movie Matewan, which is a fantastic movie.
I just watched it this week. It holds up.
Yeah, it does definitely hold up. There's some depictions of women as kind of, like, sort of wringing their hands and being maybe a little bit more passive than they actually were.
Yeah.
Not just, like, these women were actively involved in the union movement. And I think it's fair to say that without them, the union movement could not have existed.
Yeah.
These are the women who are keeping the houses running. They're the ones who are keeping the tent colonies running, too. And if
I mean, brings up an important point is, like you said earlier, when you're getting fired from the coal company, you're being evicted from your house. It's not just the man in that family that's getting evicted. It's the whole family that's being sent into this tent colony.
Yeah, so the wife of a coal miner had to be tough as he was, if not tougher.
Yeah.
And they were the ones providing all of the, like, they were doing all the caregiving labor that generally gets overlooked when we talk about labor and work. They weren't afraid to pick up a rifle if they needed to. At the raid on Holly Grove, where the Bull Moose Special raped the tent colony with machine gun fire, this woman named Maud Estep, after her husband was shot down, she picked up his rifle right where he stood and just started firing back. And, like, after the raid, once the miners figured out that this train car is going to completely outgun us, women took to direct action. They actually sabotaged rail lines.
Yeah.
Like, they would pull up spikes and roll the rails down the mountain, and as the train reached the new end of the line, they would just be standing by, kind of just laughing their heads off.
That's pretty great.
And at the battle itself, women were present. They were marching along with the miners. They were doing a lot of that same caregiving work, and a lot of women served as nurses on the sides of the miners.
Yeah.
You have to figure a few of these women probably had served overseas, too.
Yeah, served during World War I.
Yeah. And they are just as valuable to this history as the men are, but they've been overlooked for a very, very long time. And part of the reason for that, part of the reason we don't have the complete story, is they were ignored by historians, and they were ignored by people who were writing the newspaper articles and writing the reports coming back from Southern West Virginia.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, and this has been the case for a long time with all history of, we want to tell the main story, we want to get the main characters, but, you know, what are those forgotten faces that played such important roles as background characters?
Yeah.
That without them, these things don't happen.
Yeah, like, it's so easy to reduce history to like this sort of great man doing great exploits type thing, but
it's just not the whole story.
Yeah, it's never that cut and dried.
Yeah.
Like, you have so many actors who have at least some control over their own destiny and shape events, even if it's not in the most obvious way. And that's part of what we try to do with the Mine Wars Museum. We try to bring that up to the forefront.
And that leads right into that next question of how is a museum keeping the legacy of the Mine Wars and the labor movement in West Virginia?
So one of the big things that we try to do is show that this movement was not just a bunch of angry white men with rifles.
Yeah.
We show that this was a multi-ethnic, multi-racial movement. Somewhere around 20% of the miners who marched at Blair Mountain were African American.
Mm-hmm.
And you have countless languages being spoken in the coal camps. And part of the reason the red bandana was adopted was to get around some of that language barrier.
Well, especially when you're talking West Virginia.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
usually what I always say, because with where I work at a library, mm-hmm. we get a lot of phone calls in, and I work in a library in West Virginia.
Yeah.
You got to be able to speak fluent West Virginian.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes that can be difficult for people that aren't used to it. But I've lived here for 10 years. I've gotten pretty good of understanding what people here.
Yeah, the code switching definitely goes both ways, I think. But yeah, we try to tell that story as a multi-ethnic, multi-racial movement in which women played as important as a role as the men did.
Yeah.
And we try to make it clear that this is a people's history.
Mm-hmm.
It is not like, it is a history that we believe should be held in common with the people in Southern West Virginia. This isn't us dictating a story.
Yeah.
And a particular, like, we do have a narrative that runs throughout the museum, but this is a museum of, by, and for the people of Southern West Virginia.
Yeah.
And really, of anybody who has any interest in the labor movement.
And I really appreciate that, because, you know, the introduction of my show, which everybody will hear when this airs, mm-hmm. is, you know, American history is full of the good, bad, and everything in between.
Yeah.
But in the end, these are our stories. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Yeah.
And it's a collective thing, not a dictated thing.
Exactly. Yeah, that's, you hit the nail right on the head with that.
Yeah.
And some of the other ways, we're trying as much as we can to be a museum without walls.
Yeah.
One of the things that we're doing to achieve that goal is we're trying to develop relationships with West Virginia teachers,
mm-hmm.
and we encourage them to bring their classes to the museum, but we're working on projects that will allow us to take the museum to them as well.
Yeah.
And it's not just with teachers, it's also with stuff like 4-H groups.
Mm-hmm.
Someone, usually me, will go out and they'll have a presentation that they do on the Mine Wars. Just, if I can plug another project we're working on, I'm heading up a teaching trunk project.
Yeah.
And it'll have different handouts, like daily readings, activities, and artifacts that students can actually handle and see and mm-hmm. touch. It'll have, the way I like to say it is, it will have more than any teacher needs to teach a lesson about the Mine Wars.
Yeah. I'm sure you understand this when I say it, of, you know, for people going into museums,
mm-hmm.
the ability to physically touch, smell, hear things
mm-hmm.
is so much just as important as being able to just see something and read it.
I think it sort of reinforces, like, and gives a sense of ownership over the history.
Yeah.
Like, if you're looking at something behind glass, it's one thing, but if you can actually
touch it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you can actually reach out and touch, say, a piece of coal, there is, like something deeper. And I, mm-hmm. like a piece of coal is really simple. I mean, you can just go out by the side of the railroad tracks yeah. and find a piece of coal.
Yeah.
But seeing it in a specific context that you can interact with, I think that adds significance to it.
Absolutely. Well, is there anything else you'd like to plug or add?
So August the 9th, we are opening a new temporary exhibit on the educator strikes of 1990 and 2018 and 2019.
Okay.
That's the big thing that I want y'all to sort of keep an eye out for.
Yeah, and it's just so I know, in case anybody did want to come visit,
sure.
It's $5 admission.
Yeah, it's $5 admission per person, $3 for children under 10.
Okay. Well, that's awesome. Right now, we're going to take one little music break, but when we come back, I'll let you all know what's coming up next for the history book. Thanks for staying tuned through that brief musical break. I wanted to thank everyone at the West Virginia Mine Workers Museum for their awesome help and incredible museum. They really are doing some awesome things. I highly recommend taking a trip to Matewan, West Virginia to check it out, especially with all the great things they have coming to them. The next episode of the History Book will be on August 18th, and that episode will cover Flags of the U.S., a history. Until then, this has been Jacob with the History Book, and I'll see you next time.